So we've been reading Abraham's stories in Genesis. Recently, a friend told me that every time he reads that God spoke to Abraham, he feels deeply moved, which is interesting because the storyteller in Genesis doesn't actually tell us what Abraham feels about God speaking to him. What my friend feels is actually what he remembers from all the times when he felt God with him in his life, all the times when he felt God speaking with him. My friend naturally put himself into Abraham's story, and he filled in the blanks with his own experiences. And that's exactly how stories work. The Genesis storyteller wants us to inject ourselves into Abraham's life story, to see ourselves in Abraham's story so that our own memories and experiences are stirred up. We feel and we think and we ask questions, so that when we step back into our lives, back into our conversations with God, we might see life and the world with new points of view and an enlarged sense of possibilities. Today, we have the last bit of drama in Abraham's long life of trying to hold faith with God and to be faithful to God, with whom he is in a friendship alliance, and also to take care of the people around him. Because to the Christian God, faith and faithful are not just something he wants of us in our relationship with him. He also wants us to do right by the people around us. And we read a couple of examples of faithfulness in our passage today in Genesis 24, which Monica read with such lovely drama. Abraham bears the title the father of faith for the Jewish people, but he's also the patriarch of Christians and Muslims. As the story goes, God picks him out of a crowd and made him a lottery-winning offer. We're not told why him, but from him, God will birth the nation, he's told. God will grow it, watch over it, guide it, so it can become a sanctuary of good life in the world. This was what God had in mind when he made the cosmos and the Garden of Eden, before Adam and Eve walked out on God and the created world became violent and cruel and unjust. That was a coup, and we broke creation. God offers to partner with Abraham to rebuild it together. The problem with God's offer was that Abraham was 75 years old and Sarah, his wife, was 65 years old. And they've never been able to have children. 75 is how old Arnold Schwarzenegger is now, if you have seen his new movie on Netflix. I don't really know how to make sense of ages in Genesis time. Abraham lived 175 years altogether. When he met God, he still had 100 years to live, which is a whole lifetime for us. So was Abraham 75 like our 42 and Sarah our 32? I can't tell. But the storyteller says even by their standard of time, at 75 and 65, they were old and too old to bear children. So what God offered them would take a miracle. And that's the story of Abraham's life. Lots of things that happened that would not have happened if God had not shown up. And Israel and their story as a nation would not have happened if God didn't make it happen. Which would make us wonder how our life would be different. How much of it is what it is because of God's involvement and intervention. And God's involvement in Abraham's life is just like his involvement in ours, not overbearing and domineering. A relationship with God doesn't turn us into puppets with strings attached to our limbs that are entirely controlled by God's fingers. None of us get a postcard every morning telling us exactly what to expect to happen that day, instructing us on how to act and react. For the most part, our life with God, it's like Abraham. We face uncertainties and dangers without warning every day. We have to plan and make decisions and act. Some things worked out, some things work out, some things don't. God pops up sometimes with suggestions, steers opportunities our way sometimes. Sometimes he corrects our mistakes and makes up for our poor choices. But most often, he lets our decisions and actions play out. We, like Abraham, continue to have agency. Our relationship with God doesn't allow us to turn our brains off and just go on autopilot. We're still the captain of our ship, and our decisions matter and have consequences. So, the big decision Abraham had to make in our story today was how and where to find his son Isaac a wife, which continues to be one of the important decisions of our lives with a lot riding on it. It's really only been a couple hundred years that people in the West began choosing their own marriage partners. Before that, marriages were arranged by other people. At last count, 60% of the world and 90% of India still rely on matchmakers to find a suitable spouse, whether they be parents or relatives or professionals. The idea being that the decision of choosing a spouse is more than just a matter of the heart, more than feelings of attraction and chemistry. There are also practical concerns, so it is better done in committee. So here's Abraham, doing his due diligence as a dad to do right by his son. Abraham is 140 at the beginning of our story today. The storyteller starts the story by saying Abraham is now very old, even though he would still live another 35 years and even took more wives. He is really giving it all with this birthing a nation thing. So on this day, he decides it's time to find Isaac a good life partner. Perhaps it's on his bucket list of things to do, since the storyteller starts with saying Abraham is old. I guess Abraham is sensing his time running out, and this is one of his last fatherly duty to Isaac, so he can die knowing that he's done his best for his son. But I think there's another clue at the very end of the chapter to why Abraham feels a sense of urgency about getting Isaac a wife that is not just about his own mortality. Now, by my calculation, Isaac is 40, living within the family compound of tents. Sarah, his mother, has died 3 years earlier. Isaac does something out and about in the desert, doing what the Bible translator says is meditating in 2463. But the NIV translators are honest to tell us with a footnote that nobody actually knows what this word means. This is a good reason to read footnotes when we're Bible studying. Verse 67 tells us that Abraham hopes a wife would comfort Isaac after Sarah's death. So I reverse engineered this to hazard a guess, that the more urgent reason to find Isaac a wife is that Isaac misses his mother. Abraham is heartbroken watching Isaac kind of lost and mopey going on long walkabouts in the desert. Sarah was the significant female presence in Isaac's life. Abraham hoped a wife would in some way make up for that loss and help Isaac in his deep grief. I think all you parents here can relate to the anxiety parents feel about the future well-being of your children, especially after you're gone. I know three friends who have a child with a developmental disability, and I have felt this anxiety in them the times I have listened to them think out loud with me, trying to set their kids up for life after they die. The parents die. So Abraham now entrusts his head servant, his right-hand man, to go back to the old country to find Isaac a wife from among the relatives. So the servant packs up a posse of people and 10 camels full of dowry gifts and supplies to trek back to the old country, the whole way trying to figure out how to go about this task so he could do right by his boss. And so now we have the second example of a faithful man. This servant is quite a loyal character. Back when Abraham and Sarah got impatient, waiting on God to give them a son, we met a man named Eliezer, who is Abraham's majordomo, his head servant of the household. In the absence of a son, Abraham had floated the idea to God of making Eliezer his heir, but God said no, because God had in mind a real biological son. This is the same man, I think. Somebody Abraham trusts so much that he thought about leaving him everything. And this is a man now entrusted with this very important mission to find Isaac a suitable wife. I know a few friends who think they have a talent in matchmaking, and they've tried to work the magic with me over the years. I can't tell if Eliezer is one of these people. When Eliezer arrives in the old country, I think there's some anxiety when he prays to God in verse 12 to help him be successful. And he goes literally now then to the local watering hole, I guess the 4,000 euro equivalent of a pub where people go to socialize and meet people. And Eliezer waits for the young ladies of the town to come to the well to draw water for the evening. He comes up with a rather simple test. No 300 intake questions like internet dating sites. He thinks to himself, if I ask a girl for a drink and she offers to also give water to my 10 camels, then she's the one. Now, this may sound like a man with no clue about matchmaking, throwing a Hail Mary with a rather random selection criterion. But this is where we should be very impressed, and why this man is so trusted and valuable to Abraham. It turns out camels can drink gallons of water after a long trek. So it is a Herculean task for a girl with a jar that fits on top of her head or over her shoulder to hike down the steps to where the water is and back up enough times to get enough water for 10 camels. So what seems like a random task turns out to be the litmus test for a person's character. Someone who's kind, shows hospitality to strangers, which is the hallmark quality of a godly person in the Old Testament, and someone who is not afraid of hard work. Eliezer came up with this riding on a camel, that a girl like this would be a fine addition to a rancher family out there in the desert homesteading. So it seems Eliezer did a lot of deep thinking over the long camel ride about how to do right by his master, how to execute the trust Abraham put on to him. So when Rebecca shows up, she has no idea that the stranger is actually sizing her up for a job offer. And she has no idea that when she offers the water to camels, her life is about to change big time. But to Eliezer, jackpot. At this point, Eliezer knows she's the one. And rather confidently and presumptuously loaded her up with engagement jewelry. The only thing left to do now is to get her family's consent, and he can rest knowing he's done right by his master, which is the passage we read this morning, Eliezer going home with Rebecca to meet her family and ink the deal. From Abraham's instructions to Eliezer, we get a sense there's yet another concern for Abraham to find Isaac a proper wife. That is probably something even bigger at stake, something else Abraham worries about than just Isaac's personal happiness. Abraham struck a forever treaty with God, and he needed to pass that torch on to Isaac to carry forward. And again, between the lines, it seems Abraham worries about Isaac's ability to carry on his relationship with God without help. It seems Isaac is easily distracted. Maybe it's the grief, maybe the loneliness, or maybe it's just something about his personality. So Abraham worries that if Isaac ever went back to the old country, once he's in the company of cousins and uncles, he just may abandon God's arrangement with their family line and never comes back. So you must not take him back there no matter what, Abraham told his man and made him swear 24-6. And besides, back among Isaac's cousins, there's a guy named Laban who's a swindler. This guy is going to be a handful down the road when he becomes father-in-law to one of Isaac's sons, Jacob. But Jacob will outswindle him. Isaac, though, is no intellectual match to Laban's tricks. The storyteller actually winks at us in verse 30 to watch out for this Laban guy down the road, when he tells us that when Laban hears from a servant girl his sister has been approached by a strange man at the well, Laban runs out to assess the situation. And the moment he sees all the jewelry, he becomes super friendly. And he offers to put up the strangers for the night. Laban was an opportunist. Abraham didn't want Isaac anywhere near Laban, who would have eaten Isaac for lunch after taking the shirt off Isaac's back. This is also why Abraham also worries about Isaac becoming involved with a local Canaanite girl, the storyteller says in verse 3, which sounds a bit racist to our modern ears. But I guess we have to remember this was the time before it is normal for cultures to mix. Think of the native tribes in North America 200 years ago. They have complicated relationships with each other and are very cautious with each other, even hostile. For Abraham, Canaan is a geographic label, not a country. So Canaanites is like saying plains people. And Canaanites had beliefs and practices that the Bible describes as barbaric, like human sacrifices in their religion. The Genesis story begins by establishing that humans are created in the image of God with a high value, and then goes on to say that the thing God wants to do through Abraham's line is precisely to establish a new culture of people who hold to a more humane set of core values than the rest of civilization at the time. And that's why there's a code like the Ten Commandments. And God's intention is always for his people to bless the world by showing a better way to live together, to spread the values to the whole world by living it. This is still our mission as a church. So the issue for Abraham was not that the Canaanites were less than human, but the Canaanites did inhumane things. So I think Abraham didn't want Isaac to have a Canaanite wife because Isaac needed help to hold on to God's values while paddling upstream in the world's cultural currents. Isaac needed a partner with him to hold his own, being God's people, and then to pass that torch on to the next generation. So now they have found Rebecca. Everybody breathed a sigh of relief. The future looks promising. So both Abraham and Eliezer put their best foot forward to do right by Isaac and God and the thing God wanted to do in the world through them. Except even with their best effort, there were still things completely out of their control. For all of Rebecca's good qualities, for all the due diligence Eliezer put into finding her and finding out what kind of person she was to see if she'd be a suitable match for Isaac, there were still things beyond his ability to forecast and suss out. Rebecca, it turned out, struggled with the same infertility issues as Sarah. That in the end, their best effort still could not get the job done. In order for her to continue Abraham's line with Isaac, they needed divine intervention. I think by now, some of us probably have learned this in our own lives, especially over the pandemic years, and even now with all the troubles around the world, it is impossible to cover all the bases with our own effort. For those of you who live in Vancouver, did you get that message from the city? They had surveyed their aging fleet of garbage trucks and had made a plan to order replacements, only now they just found out the new trucks are not coming because of supply chain issues. So now we're having problems collecting our garbage on garbage days with a few trucks they have that still work. People did their jobs. They forecasted and planned and anticipated as they're supposed to, but the best effort still fell short because there's so much about life that is not in our control. As Robbie Burns says in his famous poem, the best laid schemes of mice and men often go askew and leave us nothing but grief and pain for promised joy. I remember a very cocky moment in my life. I think I was 14. I just did something I was really proud of, but I can't remember what that is now. But I guess it was something really impressive to a 14-year-old. I looked in the bathroom mirror with a kind of smugness and said to myself, wow, I can do anything if I put my mind to it. Well, now, almost 50 years later, with many failures and mistakes and miscalculations later, I now know how silly that was. That however gifted and capable I may think I am, I have never for a second stopped needing God to cover my back and be my overwatch and fixer. Because as good as my good foot may be, I have only got to today because God is faithful, much more than I have been faithful back to him. My grandfather did very well in business for a guy who had very little education and was left to fend for himself as a young teenager when his father died. I imagine he must have been a pretty good planner because his will was a paragon of faithfulness and fairness. He took care of all his children and the people he had a duty to. To make sure they all had what they needed to live on after him. I imagine he thought about a succession plan for his businesses and hoped for his sons to carry them on after him, except when he died in his 50s, unexpectedly, my dad and uncle in their 20s had no clue how to run a business. It would have all gone down the drain if it weren't for the fact that my grandfather had his own Eliezer, a faithful right-hand man, a Mr. Lau, who took over for his dad, running one of my grandfather's businesses supplying sheet metals to shipbuilders. When I was a kid, going to my dad's office was an adventure. Over screaming saws and banging hammers, I would walk in from the front loading bay doors, wave to Mr. Lau at his counter, and proceed to scale an iron mountain of metal plates and ingots to get to the stairs in the back to go up to the offices. Even as a kid, I noticed Mr. Lau did all the work while my dad and my uncle sat upstairs reading the newspaper and tracking the stock market. This man kept the business going after my grandfather died and worked it until the day the business closed. I'm pretty sure the business survived, in no small part because Mr. Lau, of how capable and faithful he was, who was like an uncle to my dad and uncle, and cared for us like his own family. He was God's gift to my family to do what my grandfather couldn't do. And behind it all, there was God, gracious to my grandfather's line well before I ever existed. For Abraham to be faithful to God and his son, he needed a faithful Eliezer to help him to do what he couldn't. And despite their best effort, they needed God to be faithful, to make up for what is beyond human control. So at this moment in your life, how has God been faithful to you in your life? Who are the people you feel grateful to and for because they have done right by you? And to whom do you want to do right by that you may need help with doing from God and from friends whom you can count on? There's so many decisions and variables to a good life. It's a good thing we don't have to go it alone. The older I get, the more things seem to fall through the cracks. Or is it just me? Or maybe it's the new world we live in today now. And I find I have to learn to go with the flow better. To row with the unexpected when my planning falls through, and maybe even have a sense of humor about it. And I find some comfort knowing God has my back when more and more my best effort is not quite enough. There's a moment in Julius Caesar, the play, when Brutus and Cassius are strategizing the Roman Civil War. With a country and many lives at stake, they're trying to decide where and when to strike, trying to nail down the right moves and the right time to execute them. Shakespeare wrote this for Brutus to say about trying to read the tides of life and rolling with the waves and the dangerous consequences of getting it wrong. There's a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. Omit it, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a foe sea, we're now afloat. And we must take the current when it serves or lose our ventures. Whether we like it or not, life is full of choices and decisions, big and small, and we have to tackle them until the very end. And like Abraham, we put our best effort forward, and even then, sometimes it's still not enough for smooth sailing. What God offers Abraham and us is to help us navigate the tides as we captain our vessel at all stages of our lives, so we would never be just adrift at the mercy of the currents. God offers us his friendship and adventure in learning to live life together and us learning to lean into him, especially when we feel out of control and when the requirement to hold our lives together becomes more and more out of our grasp. So here's a prayer by Kate Bowler called A Blessing for a Life You Didn't Choose. Blessed are you when the shock subsides, when vaguely you see a line appear that divides before and after. You didn't draw it and can barely even make it out. But as surely as minutes add up to hours and days, here you are, forced into a story you never would have written. Blessed are you in the tender place of wonder and dread, wondering how to be whole when dreams have disappeared and part of you with them, where mastery, control, determination, bootstrapping, and grit are consigned to the realm of before, where most of the world lives, in the fever dreams that promises infinite choices, unlimited progress, best life now. Blessed are we in the after, loudly shouting, "Is there anybody here?" We hear the echo, the shuffle of feet, the murmur of others asking the same question, together in the knowledge that we are far beyond what we know. Show us a glimmer of possibility in this new constraint. That small truth will be given back to us. We are held. We are safe. We are loved. We are loved. We are loved, and best of all, we're not alone. Amen.